be no love at all. I mean, there will never be no love at all. So build up a love on one foundation. Come, let us build our love on one solid foundation. Got to build our love on one foundation. Or there will never be a single drop of blue. You won't have no freedom, yeah. Got to come together.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us, third time scheduled, but this time here, David J. Williams, author of the Autumn Rain Trilogy, now fully complete. Stay tuned.
Cywch fy mhen, mi gliwn rhyw glomen, yn cwyn o'n gla, o beth awna, am fan wyl gymar. A nes i'w nes, yn nes i'w rando, Beth oedd y gangen ferch yn gwyno, a nes i'w nes a gofyn iddi, y lan o liw ar fwyna'n fyw, beth yw dy gledi? Y glomen fwyn o paid a chwyno, fe gyfyd hael ar fronydd eto, a phan y del daw'r coed i ddeilio, ti gofyn dda pan ddel o'r ha, daw'r gweilch i rodio. Ynghwr y coed, mi glywn y glomen, yn cwyno'n glaf am ei hanwyl gymar, ac am ei gwdd roedd air yn glychau, lle bu'n faith do lawer gwaith, fy nwy fraich i nai.
Os wyt ti am ymryson canu, cais dy sgol ag eistedd ar nir, ni ymryson am tan y bore, cyn y rod am i ti'r gore. Fal di ral, rai di ro, fal di ral, di rei di ro.
Mae gen i ne o benillion, rif y blith ar ddolydd gleision, a phe mae bles er gen i'r ganu, gwnawn i ti a thgwn i dewi.
Fal di ral, rai di ro, fal di ral, di rei di ro.
Gat lind yn y gyffrin, llygau bwch a danedd mochyn, a dwi droed fel gwadan arad, fel tyddi yn mae hi'n siarad.
Fal di ral, rai di ro, fal di ral, di rei di ro.
Tebyg yw dy lais di'n canu, i hen fywch pan mo hi'n brefi, na i gyd all yn clepian cyfarth, wedi colli'r ffordd i'r buarth.
Fal di ral, rai di ro, fal di ral, di rei di ro.
Debyg ydwy ti'r dyllian, o bren i bren bydd honno i hunan, a phob deryn yn ei ffigo, debyg iawn wyt ti ddeu honno.
Fal di ral, rai di ro, fal di ral, di rei di ro.
Os tebyg ydwy fi'r dyllian, sydd o bren, hyd y creigiau bydd hi'n crawcian.
Fal di ral, rai di ro, fal di ral, di rei di ro.
Rwyf yn ofer, rwyf yn gyfed, rwyf yn gwyl i blad i'n gweled, rwyf yn yfed fel di'n gwirion, fei o fed wyt fi a'i ffaldion.
Fal di ral, rai di ro, fal di ral, di rei di ro. Os wyt ti am ymryson canu, cais dy sgol ag eistedd arni, mi ymryson am tan y bore, cyn y rodd a fi ti'r gore. Fal di ral, rai di ro, fal di ral, di rei di ro.
Well, not edgy, you know, not like gripping music, but pleasant indeed. And oh, you see, I didn't have the hard drive plug. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is called Hour of the Wolf. The name is allegedly Jim Freund. And this is a weekly program of science fiction and related fields of endeavor. Science fiction, fantasy and related fields of endeavor. Now, before we get to the show proper, let's see, what announcements do we have? None. No real strong announcements. There's no readings this week. No TV shows that I can think of that you must be alerted to. Doctor Who is over, and it was on BBC America, you know, with commercials anyway. But I liked the end. I have to say it was a touchy-feely. Oh, that's right. We all have to, like, turn off our phones. David is turning off his phone, and I have to do the same. I had a very embarrassing time. I was eulogizing somebody on the air, and right in the middle of the thing, my phone announced an incoming email saying its name. It's the phone that dares to say its name.
Yikes.
And it was, so I had this in my pocket over here, right as you all at home can see, about 6 inches from the microphone, and right in the middle of eulogizing somebody, it just droid, and that was like, oh God, not, that was an inappropriate droidal moment. Okay, so... No, I really can't think. Oh, yes, I have a huge, a sorrowful announcement of sorts. Next week, I had announced we were going to be doing Altered Fluid, which is to say the entire writers group would come here, and one member of the group, in this case, K. Tempest Bradford, would read a story. We've done this 5 or 6 times with different members of the group. And this is arguably the most terrifying thing I think that a writer can do, is read the first draft of a story to their group, much less on the radio, and then have every member of the group critique that story. You know, basically shred it live on the air. And then, if that wasn't horrifying enough, take listener phone calls. And we were going to do this next week with Tempest Bradford, and she is she's a dynamo, and she's a fine writer, but also as a personality, she's this very vibrant and strong thing. I want to do a radio drama first. She sent me a project that really, really looks good. At any rate, we were going to do that next week. And lo and behold, last week, during the week, they announced yet another fundraising drive. So instead of bringing you a program next week, we will be doing the recitation of a phone number and asking you to pledge. And the next available date that I had for this hopefully twice a year event with Altered Fluid on the show was at the end of the month, to which they said a few of us are going, and this is 12 people we're coordinating, and they said a few of us are going to be at Worldcon, to which the only thing one can say, especially given where Worldcon will be, is crikey.
Get ready for jet lag.
Exactly. So it's going to be in mid to late September that Altered Fluid will be here, and that Tempest will read her story. And I am very sorrowful for that. We have had all kinds of, and thanks to fund drives, all kinds of rescheduling problems and issues this year. Starting with, when is it, David, that we were going to have you on initially? It was
early June initially.
Yeah, early so, June. And
so still the summer.
Yeah, but the fundraising drive that started in May extended itself into June. Then we set up a date on in early July. And then there was an opportunity for an out-of-town writer by the name of Paolo Bacigalupi was in town. I purposely, when I emailed you, David, I didn't mention the name. I didn't want the idea of who it was to influence your thought. And you were exceedingly gracious.
I would have been all the happier as well, knowing it's Paolo. That's
yeah, great. And he's a great guy, and it was wonderful having him here. A very cool, and a good reader, by the way. And But I had already bumped you twice, and when the second book came out, we had scheduling issues, didn't we?
I seem to recall that.
We had to reschedule you. And I should tell listeners that David J. Williams comes to us via Washington.
Indeed.
So you're here almost exclusively for the show.
Exclusively.
Exclusively,
yes.
You come up just
yes,
for the show.
Indeed, indeed.
Thank you so much for that, and thank you for being so good.
No, by all means.
Especially with the traveling and being flexible. And also, you know, the point is the book came out, the new book, The End of the Autumn Rain Trilogy, came out in May?
End of May. Exactly.
So when an author is doing an author's tour, you like it to be in the same year as when the book came out.
And we are indeed there.
We are indeed there, but you did do a national tour.
Yeah, a lot of readings up and down the East and West Coasts.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was following it all on Twitter and Google and on your blog.
It's been fun. The third book, Machinery of Light, has gone into a second printing, so I'm pretty excited about
wow.
that.
Wow, okay,
yeah.
So it really took off. How many were in the first printing?
I don't even really remember, actually.
But not enough, apparently.
But not enough, yeah, exactly.
That's a good thing.
Exactly.
To go into the second printing. And, oh, second week in a row, we have a guest here who has a book out from Phantom Spectra.
How about that?
Yeah, but complete coincidence. And by coincidence, I do tech support work, computer work for various people, and I was working with a former editor at Phantom Spectra.
Ah, yeah, indeed.
But, yeah. Let me ask you, move those headphones a little bit. I think they are feeding back. Ah, much better.
That, the little...
But yeah,
yes.
You either wear them, but if we lay them on the table near the microphone...
I was wondering what that was.
It gives that lovely, shrill little sound.
Yes.
A little feedback. So, was I in the middle of a story? I digress. I was at a party last night when you called, in fact, the end of the Paleozoic era.
How about that?
Party, which Ken Gale here of WBAI holds once a year. And a lovely event it is. But, you know, he holds this party every year in the Paleozoic. We haven't made it. The Mesozoic era hasn't begun yet. And there's another party to be had for the start of the Mesozoic era.
There's a lot of opportunity for party going there.
Yeah, there really is. There really is. But last night, so I didn't stay late, but nevertheless, I didn't get a lot of sleep. So I do ramble.
Well, with this coffee you've got here, Jim, I think we're doing okay.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
good coffee.
That's what Mary Hobson said last week. She M.K. Hobson, who's the other person whose book is just coming out from Phantom Spectra. But yours already has.
Mine has indeed.
And I know how I wanted to intro. And this was something that I wanted to point out with when Paula was here as well. And that is, I think that science fiction has become what they use in theater. They used to call theater, the legitimate theater, the fabulous invalid. Every year, the newspapers would pronounce the theater is dead. Nobody's going to the theater. Broadway is, you know, there's no good plays coming out. That O'Neill guy, you know, whatever. There's nothing really happening. And then they turn around, and each time they make this pronouncement, theater has another landmark year.
Mm-hmm.
And as yeah, maybe one may not be thrilled about what some of the theater is, but it's doing well and snuck into that you know, legitimate theater. It's, what, 3 years ago since I saw an 11-hour play by Tom Stoppard at Lincoln Center. The Coast of Utopia, and there's actually some 7 or 8 hour play about to open on Broadway. There is a lot of straight, legitimate theater, and even the occasional good musical opening. Theater has been called by the press the fabulous invalid, because people say, oh, you know, it's on its last legs, and it's always getting stronger. And I propose that science fiction is another fabulous invalid. People have been predicting its death for years. So much that comes out now is fantasy or fantastic in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Even the writing, a lot of the writing of that's borderline like China Mieville, The City and the City. Is it science fiction? Is it fantasy? I think it's a stupid discussion. It's a good book.
Mm-hmm.
But so much of what's coming out, so much of what's selling is fantasy, and certainly a lot of what's coming out in cinema, if it is science fiction, pays no attention to the fact that it's science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, literature-wise, it's interesting because from a commercial perspective, it's very much true, right? The urban fantasy tale is... been wagging the science fiction dog for a few years now, but, you know, seen in the broader light, it's all literature of the fantastic.
In the broader light, absolutely. But then there, but you will get certain people, you know, I mean, the people who belong to the Lester Del Rey camp of that's not science fiction, and, you know, it made a sound in space. You know, well, this is how Lester was for those who. I certainly recall. It was a different studio, but it was still WBAI, an Hour of the Wolf, where he would make pronouncements like that. And certainly he would do so in essays, and certainly that was reflected in Del Rey books.
Well, I think the interesting question to my mind is, how does science fiction evolve or change as we enter a science fiction age? You know, I mean, part of me wonders whether the rise of urban fantasy, for example, is a response to that.
It's a good question.
And I you know, can't pretend to have the answer, right? But even if you look at a lot of science fiction, I mean, this is the interesting thing about doing near-future science fiction like the Autumn Rain trilogy. It's a lot of, you know, hard science fiction is really space opera, right? It's far future. You know, it's very removed science fictions, you know. That
a lot of it has to be in order... to allow the technology
to get to that stage. Exactly. Particularly if you're positing, you know, FTL drives or what have you.
Yeah. But even, I mean, Kim Stanley Robinson in his Mars trilogy, which is, he's written a lot of other great stuff, but that Mars trilogy is just one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, that's a brilliant set.
It really is. And by the time Red Mars, the first book in that series, went from hardcover to paperback, it was out of date.
Yeah.
New information was coming in. Not that events had occurred, but new information was coming in. New science was understood about Mars.
Yeah, it's the perils of writing about, you know, the near future, and certainly Stan still pulled it off with much aplomb. But I think, you know,
his near future is about the same as that in the Autumn Rain trilogy. It's about 100 years hence, right?
Yeah, it's about 100 years hence. And what I found interesting about, you know, doing that is how people could have such strong opinions about it, right? Whereas, you know, in reality, so much of this is uncertain, right? I mean, you've got guys out there who'll sit through, you know, endless tales of faster than light travel and the singularity and what have you. But, you know, you tell them, hey, I think Russia might still be a superpower 100 years from now, and suddenly they're foaming at the mouth, right?
Yeah.
They're like, no, that couldn't possibly be the case. And people have strong opinions about the near future. That was an occupational hazard of writing the Autumn Rain trilogy I wasn't aware of as I, you know, dived into it. You know,
well, the Autumn Rain trilogy, with the G in trilogy, makes me say range, Autumn Range. And the Autumn Rain trilogy is political in the nature of, well,
intensely so.
What it is about. We're dealing with, you know, in 1960s terms, as it were, we're looking in the White House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we're looking at world leaders, their intimate lives, what they're doing, and we're doing it in. An amazing manner. When you step away from the trilogy, having read the whole thing now, and take a look at it, it could perhaps be summarized in ways that make it seem like other science fiction that has been done. But when you open the book and start reading, it's nothing like what you've ever read. It's using present tense, very difficult thing to pull off in a short story, much less a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
But you manage it well. It takes a little acclimating, but once you're there, you're there. It's really, really tough. That's a tightrope act.
Part of that. Part of it, I think, was I just remember reading a quote by a guy at the University of Melbourne saying you have to give back to the past tense its own present tense, you know, and you're trying to sort of drop people into the immediacy of, you know, there's a certain comfort in the past tense. You know, we almost, there's an implied hindsight, there's an implied narrative of everything's going to come out all right. And there was an interesting review that
That's
came.
That's an interesting point, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and all the more so when you're talking about the future. But in some ways, it's, you know, what I was trying to do with that tense is you know, marry it up to the political. You know, that one of the reasons I was writing about the near future, I mean, it's like Stephen Hawking has said, it's going to be the next couple hundred years that decide the fate of the species. You know, do we go on and become a star-faring species, or do we just collapse back in upon ourselves and possibly wipe ourselves out with existential hardware, or weaponry, rather. And, you know, the Autumn Rain trilogy is very much a trilogy where, you know, we have our geopolitical nightmares, you know, extended. It's very much a narrative about power, you know. So as you say, we do see, you know, the White House, but you see it from a distance at first,
yes.
Right? It's not one of these things that opens with the president, the director of the CIA sitting around a table. You gradually get to the point where the machinations of those in power become clear. And, you know, living in Washington, D.C., you know, I know that, you know, the you know, some of the realities of that. I mean, the biggest enemy of the U.S. Army is the U.S. Navy, right? I mean, they're competing for the same funding. And so what would that look like in 100 years?
And actually, when you watch lighthearted World War II movies, it's always the Navy and the Army.
Yeah, and it would be what would that really look like, you know? And because what always struck me as perhaps, you know, ringing a little bit false about the original vision of cyberpunk is this notion that the state would wither away. I see no evidence the state is withering away. I see every evidence that the state is becoming bigger and meaner and uglier, and that's true of whether you're on the left or the right end of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, the Autumn Rain trilogy was a response to what I take to be the militarization of U.S. society across the last several years. I mean, the Autumn Rain trilogy is set 100 years from now, and the U.S. has ceased to be a republic and has started to become an empire. Some would say that's already happened, but here it's really happened domestically as well.
Yeah, I would say that Autumn Rain trilogy is very much a post-9/11, if this goes on, book.
Yes, yes. Ironically, it was started before 9/11.
Oh, yes.
When I started writing it, I mean, the book itself, but particularly, as I said, living in Washington, D.C., it very much became a response to those years of perpetual alert and the anxiety of a second strike. I mean, obviously, the first book begins with the destruction of the Phoenix Space Elevator by the mysterious terrorists, Autumn Rain, and
mm-hmm.
there's very much a Twin Towers parallel going on there.
Yeah, we should, of course, point out that we are broadcasting from about six blocks away.
Right,
The Twin Towers,
or right,
the Ground Zero, whatever you want to call it.
Exactly.
But that's where we are right now. The very fact that when I gave David instructions on how to get here, cabbies who've been in New York for years still don't quite know how to navigate the Wall Street area because of 9/11. It's still very much impact, as it were, on the very building that we're in here on the corner of Wall Street and South Street.
And it'll be an impact on, you know, in many ways, the not just those who lost their lives, but the rest of our lives, you know. And
yeah,
this is, for me, the scariest thing about the last several years has been the fact that no one has ever defined the victory conditions of the war we're in right now.
That's
which,
right.
Suggests to me, I mean, that's very Orwellian.
Oh,
it's perpetual war.
There is. And in fact, there was just interesting that you should put it that way, because there was just a story in the news yesterday, at least I read it yesterday, that was all about, I think, the U.S. trying to define with other nations what cyber war
yes. Yes.
You know, what are the ground rules in computer-based warfare? In other words, in, you know, not internet per se, but... Yes, internet.
Also internet as well. I mean, there's been a lot of interesting talk lately about the, you know, the so-called internet kill switch, right? And the idea of what would happen in a cyber attack and, you know, who would ultimately have responsibility there. And to me, what it underscored, and this is something I was thinking very hard about in writing the Autumn Rain trilogy, is that the World Wide Web is in its infancy still. We're still in a Wild West phase. Now, is it going to get to the point where, you know, as it does in the Autumn Rain trilogy, where the worldwide net is literally balkanized along geopolitical lines? You have an Eastern net and you have a Western net, and there's some communication between them, but basically the world has gone completely bipolar, an Eastern superpower, a Western superpower, the US, and they've cauterized and fractured their nets as well as part of that. That would presume a breakdown in, you know, near breakdown in globalization, which, you know, may yet happen with peak oil just around the corner. Mm-hmm. But the point being that these nets are being militarized and are militarized already. I mean, the internet was a Pentagon creation originally. Right. And, you know, the militaries...
It was created by the DOD.
Yes.
On the grounds that if you have computers in multiple places, what happens if there's a strike? What happens if a coast... disappears, and an inter-network would allow that to continue operating if you use a hub-based topology or star-based topology instead of a serial topology where one computer just talks to another. And that was why the internet was funded by the DOD and created by AT&T and some other companies.
Exactly.
And into ARPANET, just...
And you've got, on the one hand, you know, Russia and China talking about, you know, cyber warfare and, you know, and that's going on right now, right? I mean, the interest that, you know...
Just take a look at the story of Google in China.
Yeah, exactly. And the continual attacks on DoD servers, because what's interesting about cyber warfare is it's not a warfare that's declared. It's a warfare that goes on the same way that your... body's immune response is going on right now.
That's a very good way of putting it.
Dealing with what, right? I mean, so when we talk about the militarization of society, you know, there's a certain sense in which combining geopolitics with the next incarnation of the web, it's already occurring, and is going on right now. And so I was trying to think of, you know, I think what's happening right now is that, you know, the original, you know, vision, you know, of Wired magazine or what have you of the web is almost, you know, the 90s is sort of this utopian thing that'll set us all free. It may yet, but there's also a lot of evidence to suggest that it will become a tool of state control. And I worry that we're not as alive as we should be to the dangers there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, and people do have to remember what the, you know, what the provenance of the internet is. I'm always careful to not mention the web. The web is a brand new creation. Started, it became the commercial web in 1995, and only existed for about 3 or 4 years before that, and I was actually working on it before it began.
Yeah,
at that time I was with Ziff Davis and working on CompuServe. But
and that's the thing, right? And now, you know, today, you know, for folks that becomes quote ancient history. Mm. And what's interesting to me about that is that. And this is where, you know, I think we circle back on the original point about, you know, what is the future of science fiction, where it's going, is it's just how short-term our species is getting in thinking about things,
right?
Right? Which is fascinating to me, right? In that, like, you know, we no longer think more than a few years ahead. And that wasn't always the case, right? I mean, in medieval times, they thought nothing about starting a cathedral that they would never finish in their lifetimes.
Yeah, multi-generational.
And would go for generations. We need that thinking more than ever right now, and we just don't have it. When you get back to the internet, I mean, I think the other connection that most people miss is the extent to which it is dependent on physical assets, right? I mean, that you can write all the freedom of information manifestos you want, but if I control your phone lines and I control your satellites, I control your web. And it's like when Russia invaded Georgia, they shut down the Georgian net.
Yeah.
They just basically switched it off.
I mean, this is why for many years WBAI was an EBS station. If something were to happen, this was one of the stations you would tune into. We're in the middle of the FM dial. We're 99.5 FM.
Right.
So we used to have a bright orange thing by the remote control unit, the EBS checklist. Why is that so important? Why, if there's an event that would, and BAI has, God help us, such a political place, if somebody were to have yet another insurgency here, yeah, which happens, every few minutes, it seems, why was it so important? Well, because the very first thing that happens is the radio stations. This was the thinking with Conelrad and from the 40s and onward. It's the communications that are the first things that a real insurgency tried to grab.
Right, right.
And when radio was it, EBS and the Conelrad system and all that were extremely important to national security.
Yep, yep.
And that is still true, only the focus is a little bit away from radio, although it's still there in case of national emergency. What they will still be telling, they're not going to be saying log into www.
Right.
Whatever, or, check out your iPhone or something like that. It will be using broadcast communications.
Right, exactly, exactly. I mean, much the same way on 9/11, you could only watch the TV. You couldn't, get online or anything like that. I mean, I think the other factor that I think often gets missed, the one I was alluding to earlier, is the extent to which cyber warfare is very much tied to space warfare and, the coming impending weaponization of space, which is, of course, the other one of the central themes of the Autumn Rain trilogy is what's that really going to look like once the heavens get weaponized? I mean,
yeah,
they're already militarized, right? I mean, every time a GI in Iraq uses GPS, mm-hmm, that's using space-based assets. The question becomes, what happens when the other side attacks your space-based assets? And that's something that China and Russia are gearing up to do. And the other part of that is the impending maturity of directed energy weaponry. I mean, 100 years from now, we will literally have the ability to hit any point on the planet at the speed of light in real time. And so what does that mean, right? I mean, the 40s and 50s, you're talking about a reaction time of, the bombers are coming over the pole, and then it's eventually the ICBM. But it will be instantaneous, and that sort of hair trigger response is again likely to redound to the further anxiety and militarization of societies domestically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're mentioning that, and on TV two nights ago, I tuned in for 1 minute on Turner Classic Movies, and I saw Failsafe.
Mm.
And this is a movie I cannot bear to watch, being a New Yorker. And why do they always destroy New York, by the way? Why is it always New York?
Because it's so darn dramatic.
Yeah, but and P.S. when it came to real life, so far, it was
mm-hmm.
New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not the only target, but certainly the one that was hit.
Yeah, that and D.C. I mean, you're looking for targets that are recognizable to your home constituencies.
Exactly,
recognizable worldwide.
And think of Failsafe. Think of I grew up in the 60s. I grew up, I grew up in the 50s, but I was a young teen in the 60s. And I had the nightly apocalyptic nightmares.
Of course,
The mushroom-shaped cloud nightmares that don't always go away, and they occur again. And when you take it into the extrapolation and the future that you're talking about, we no longer have the luxury of thinking about that kind of a thing. The lighthearted concept of war games,
yeah,
the Matthew Broderick,
sure,
John Badham movie, is a luxury.
Well, I grew up in the tail end of the Cold War, the last big surge of the Cold War in the 80s, and I'm certainly familiar with those nuclear nightmares you talk about. A lot of kids of my generation, myself included, honestly, never really thought we'd grow up. I mean, in our hearts, they just didn't seem any way that there wouldn't ultimately be, with all the saber rattling in the 80s, some sort of total nuke out. And what stunned me at the end of the Cold War is the amnesia that occurred. You had a guy like Francis Fukuyama go on and proclaim, it's the end of history. This is it. The culmination of liberal capitalism. And to anyone with a science fiction mindset, that seemed palpably absurd. And it was, I think, real evidence of the extent to which our so-called intellectual class does not have a science fiction mindset. It is not prepared to, navigate this species in the long term. And so I think that's one of the reasons that I was putting together the Autumn Rain trilogy based around a second Cold War, based around the idea of, a new Eastern superpower, and a quote from a U.S. military planning paper where someone postulates that there could be a convergence between the rise of a peer competitor and the technology that could threaten U.S. military dominance, because it would be a different kind of Cold War. You would have the industrial strength missile shields that Reagan dreamt of, mm-hmm, will be reality in 100 years, regardless of how you feel about that.
Regardless of the politics of it.
It will be a reality. And those industrial strength missile shields will not just be shields. They will be offensive weaponry capable of attacking the other guy's shields and the other guy's homeland. And so in the Autumn Rain trilogy, you have these two superpowers that have essentially fortified the Earth-Moon system. They've turned the Earth-Moon system into an armed camp. And as I said, the space warfare very much integrated with cyber warfare. So I was trying to sketch out what that looks like as part of a broader commentary on power.
Mm-hmm. And how did the... You started writing this, as I recall from the first time you were on the show, actually somewhere in the mid to late 90s, right?
Started writing it in 2000, actually. It was probably perhaps brewing in my subconscious in the late 90s as I started to wonder, what I wanted to ultimately do with my life, quote unquote. But I actually started in about fall of 2000.
Now, here's a chicken or egg question, because the book is not only about, I say the book, but this is three books, The Mirrored Heavens, The Burning Skies, and The Machinery of Light.
Yes.
All together, and hopefully we'll see a bound version of Autumn Rain. That would be nice.
An omnibus, that would be quite cool.
No, that would be, anybody listening out there at Bantam or wherever, it would be a good marketing ploy. But anyway, my chicken or egg question.
Yes.
Which was, you have not sacrificed storytelling. You've not sacrificed character, which is usually when a lot of people are writing hard science fiction. And one of the reasons why a lot of writers, I think, have turned to fantasy is and YA, young adult books, or rewriting their books as young adult, is it's very easy to simply let go of the science, to let go of the world that could be. It's not a predictive state, but it's a question of plausibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the first things that disappears in science fiction, and was certainly not present in the inception of science fiction, is characterization.
Right.
I mean, science fiction in its modern phase post Mary Shelley begins with Hugo Gernsback, and for its first 40 years or so, right through the John W. Campbell era, characters really don't exist until Sturgeon invents them.
Right.
Science fiction. In Autumn Rain, fast forward, in Autumn Rain, we're not only rediscovering hard science fiction, which, again, as I was saying earlier, as the fabulous invalid, I'm not sure that it was ever sick. I'm not sure that it was ever away, but it hasn't taken the marketing forefront. Fantasy really took over the bookshelves in the stores, but good science fiction was there if you looked for it.
Right, right.
Unfortunately, Sturgeon's Law, mentioning his name again, always applies. The bad science fiction, you know, 95% of all science fiction is pure crud.
Right,
and I think that is still true. And I think the difference is that 95% isn't taking up shelf space the way it used to.
And perhaps to anticipate your question in that regard, I mean, it was one of those things where in trying to think, you know, in trying to create something that would be competitive in the marketplace.
And in that 5%.
And in that 5%, right, exactly. And that would tell the reflect the themes that I wanted to sort of unfold.
Yes, you are anticipating.
I was toggling back and forth between, you know, years and years of, you know, working on the world building, working on the plot, and working on the characters. And these are characters 100 years from now, and they're all of a type, that they're all agents of different kinds for different branches or different arms or different commands of the U.S. government. Some are mechs, you know, so they're specialists in physical combat. Some are razors, so they're specialists in hacking in zones, you know, William Gibson's Netrunners. And they're all verging very much on post-human in many ways.
Yeah.
So that was one of the and they also don't want you inside their head. So, you know, they've all got their dilemmas, you know.
Yeah, people have referred to the Autumn Rain as cyberpunk, and I really see it as post-cyberpunk.
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, there was a review that just came out that addressed that very question, where, you know, someone.
Was that the one you sent me?
That was the one I sent you. Yeah,
it was very good. It was deep.
It was a very deep analysis by a guy who's a professor of literature at UToronto, University of Toronto, and writes a great blog, Traveling Without Moving, I believe is the name of it. But it was the point.
And he'd only read the first book.
Well, exactly. He's only read the first book, so I'll be, you know, very intrigued to see what he thinks of the rest of it. But what struck me is he was saying, you know, that he was responding to some of the book's critics who were saying this is not cyberpunk, that cyberpunk is, you know, street hackers and street samurai fighting against the power, and yet everybody in Williams's books are, you know, government agents. They're fighting for the power. And he was making the point that it's a redirecting. It's a conscious redirecting. He's right, quite right.
I think that of
cyberpunk. Because to me, cyberpunk, the essence of cyberpunk is about alienation. And there's no reason for me to see that government agents can't be alienated from the power they serve. That everyone in these books has deep anxiety about who they're working for.
That's where John le Carré.
Right.
What makes his spy novels so superior to so many others is because he understood that alienation. He understands, I should say, because he's still writing the stuff.
Yeah, you see the personal conflict of a guy like Smiley in George Smiley in Le Carré, and then you think about, well, what would that be like if, you know, Smiley was someone who was enhanced to the point where, you know, their own character almost started to be a little bit flattened in a sense, that one senses with, you know, all these characters that, you know, A, as I said earlier, they don't want you inside their head, you know, B, you know, they often have dilemmas that you're not going to see right now. So, for example, in the first book, we've got, you know, Marlowe and Haskell, two agents who, you know, used to be in love 10 years previously, and they haven't seen each other in 10 years. But now, then they learn early on. I'm not really giving anything away because it's on the back cover that someone's manipulate their handlers are manipulating their memory. So, were they ever really in love? I mean, what's going on there? Who's pulling their strings? The anxiety of influence, as it were. And one starts to sense with a lot of these characters that their ultimate loyalty is less to the United States or even to the command that they serve, and more to the peak experience that they've been engineered around.
Yeah, you know, simply glibly like a corporate thing. What was that really fun movie with Julia Roberts and Clive Owen?
Oh, yeah, the one about the banks. I don't remember the title, but yeah, exactly.
Really cute. Fun little identity-based spy flick with the two spies, you know, jumping in and out of bed. Exactly. But very, very clever, very well done. And that's like the comedy version.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it brings it back home to, well, wait a minute, intelligence services, yes, there's all the corporate stuff going on, and this is, you know, not a new idea, and wasn't a new idea with Rollerball either. This is...
Right.
But when you get down to it, it still does get back to the government. Whether the government becomes a corporation, whatever they are, it's still going to be what governs you.
It's still what has the power, Mao Zedong's phrase about power sprouting from the barrel of a gun. I mean, that's ultimately what's happening. And, you know, I suspect it will, that the power will continue to accrete around nationalist loyalties. Mm-hmm. And geopolitical and centralized in a sense, mm-hmm. You know, there's all this talk right now of, you know, fourth generation insurgencies and warfare, and obviously that's what's vexing us so much in Iraq and Afghanistan, are these insurgencies. But I think ultimately nation states will retool themselves and become even more powerful. I mean, you know, if you had to predict, you know, if you look at the U.S. Constitution and think about, you know, where's the weak point in the system, which of these three branches is likely ultimately to usurp the others? I think it's pretty clear that ultimately when historians write that history, they're going to say it was the executive branch that took over the others, that accrued power to the point where, in the name of national security, that accrued power to the point where, you know, it was no longer a functioning democracy. That's the primary danger that we face right now. So, you know,
hopefully to a limited extent we're moving away from that, but if one just takes a look at what happened post 9/11 and the corralling of power and the lines that were crossed that we're hearing about a lot of, but God knows what we're not hearing about.
Yeah, exactly, who knows what we're not hearing about. Then there was a disinclination on the part of the current administration to do a true, real, thorough investigation of the predecessor, and I can understand
that. Or at least a public, whether they investigated it or not, it hasn't been brought out to the public. I always suspect that, you know, we only ever see the tip of the iceberg.
But yeah. I think the point that people miss, though, is that regardless of whether they're on the left or the right, is that whoever is in charge doesn't give up the powers that his predecessor accrued.
Right.
You never see that. That's the one that they may discharge the functions of state more competently.
I think that's what opened a lot of people's eyes to the new administration. This administration's ideology is as different as could possibly be from its predecessor, and yet there are all the things that are still as withheld. All the things that are still in place.
Yeah, there was nothing that was given up, partially for domestic political reasons.
But the closing of Guantanamo Bay doesn't change certain.
It doesn't change the fundamental realities that, you know, this you know, the nation took further steps towards its national security, a certain manifestation of its national security apparatus.
Yeah.
And this was something that I was trying to get beyond, is that we're this whole left versus right mentality is killing us. And it's, you know, where we if we're left wing, we ignore the sins of the left. If we're right wing, we ignore the sins of the right. I mean, each area.
I disagree. Here at WBAI, we're completely left wing, and we're always attacking the left. So, yeah, I mean, the infighting here is tremendous.
Well, the infighting is something else altogether. But I guess where I'm going with that is that one thing I noticed.
I just had to get a snarky.
Well, it's one thing I noticed about, you know, the presentation of political figures in science fiction is that it's always done through the prism of ideology, right? So, you know, you get the right wingers writing about, you know, these sort of
you know, weak-kneed liberal presidents, and you get the left-wingers writing about these warmongering right-wing presidents. And so in creating a president, you know, Andrew Harrison, 100 years from now, I wanted to put someone who was sort of beyond all that, who was, you know, a flawed but perhaps even great figure, you know, very much a product of his times, and someone who's run the United States for 20 years, you know, so we would see him as simply an autocrat by today's standards, and yet he's the one who has led the United States out of chaos. So there were multiple ways to look at him, and
it's funny because I remember talking to you with the first two books, and now, of course, with the hindsight of having read the third book, talking about Harrison is like, oh, I remember those old days. We've gone so far beyond.
One gets almost nostalgic once once the succession gets implemented. Yes.
Yeah. And you know, sadly, we can't talk too much about that because, as Alex Kingston is so fond of saying on Doctor Who, spoilers. But
yeah, they are tough to avoid when it comes to a reading of book three. But some of that is on the back of book three cover, so
yeah.
it's very hard to avoid 3 years in.
Yeah, exactly. Or just opening, you know, just cracking the cover, the very first page. There's no avoiding.
There will be some spoilers in that, but I will also sort of note that, you know, we've been talking about the geopolitics of it. We've been talking about, you know, the what is in very ways the veneer of the Autumn Rain trilogy, right? Because, you know, what this is all about ultimately is Autumn Rain itself, this next level.
And we haven't even done the précis here.
Yeah.
And since we're moving toward 6 a.m., at which point we're going to first take a musical break.
For sure.
And then you're going to read. I think that we should tell, we've given people the flavor, the setting, really more talking about today, the today that is reflected in the future of the trilogy. But why don't we give them a bit of a précis of what is it actually about? What is Autumn Rain? It's not a weather report.
Right, no, this is quite true.
Although the Weather Underground was not a weather report either.
Perhaps a predecessor. Well, we've given a little bit of a sense of the world of the early 22nd century. So set in a bipolar framework, East versus West, the militarization of U.S. society. But, you know, the Autumn Rain trilogy is ignited early on in the Mirrored Heavens by the destruction of the Phoenix space elevator, which was the intended symbol of détente between the two superpowers. And so, essentially, it's
explain basically what a space elevator is.
A space elevator, a beanstalk. So basically, a piece of apparatus, a hardware that would allow for the acceleration of freight into orbit. The classic one being, for example, in Arthur C. Clarke's Fountain of Paradise, something that's rooted to the Earth's equator and that stretches out through the geosynchronous orbit. This is the space elevator light. It's a 4,000-kilometer-long structure that rotates around the Earth.
I'm so glad that you mentioned Clarke, because if there's anybody who's writing after I have read it, your work resembles in my memory, it's Clarke's.
Wow, that's
in other words, reading it is not necessarily like reading Clarke, which is a good thing. this is, but when you're done with it and when you're left with a certain sense of wonder and where this is taking you in terms of, oh, now I see things differently, it resembles Clarke a great deal.
Well, if that's the afterglow that's left resonating, that's praise indeed.
It is.
I appreciate that. The elevator piece is in some ways an aspect of how one calibrates the future, right? I mean, looking at 100 years from now, a huge geosynchronous beanstalk struck me as totally a big tower to the star struck me as unrealistic. But I could easily see something that's, you know, like I said, 4,000 kilometers long, rotating around the Earth. If you reach it, you only need to attain suborbital velocities to get into orbit. But it's really a symbol. I mean, it's East and West have decided to bury their differences and work together. And when that gets blown up by the mysterious terrorist group Autumn Rain, they you know, who is a terrorist group and more than that, you know, takeover artists, you know, intent on subverting the U.S. government from within and perhaps even the East. it starts to set the process of emotion of, you know, both East and West are sliding towards war, being instigated by Autumn Rain, even as a worldwide and moonwide hunt for this next level terrorist group is going on. And obviously there's something going on behind the scenes as well. I mean, the Autumn Rain is just the tip of the iceberg of a larger set of experiments, one might call them, that, you know, that the whole geopolitical situation is really just the chessboard for a larger plan that's in motion that really, I think, only becomes evident in book three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And the denouement of book three, it's lovely because you don't see it at all in book one. You don't really know where it's going, and it resembles Clark in that aspect as well.
And there are threads
in the cosmic end. It is a cosmic conclusion.
It is, isn't it? And those threads are there, right? I mean, the in retrospect, as you look back over it and think, gee, the implication of say Claire Haskell, let's say, at the end of book one, mm-hmm. you know, not to give anything huge away here, but, you know, there are questions that are set up there that have to be answered.
Right.
And there's, you know, as we start to, you know, unfold, you know, what this woman is capable of and you know, Claire Haskell's tragedy in many ways, and I think she is, you know, the signature character of the series, you know, is that she perhaps more than anyone else in these books wants to have a normal life, would like to have a normal life, is never going to have a normal life, mm-hmm. Is very much a weapon, and, you know, is being used by everybody and ultimately has to sort of come into her own in that sense. But those questions have to be answered. And so that's in some ways why, you know, now that you've read the end of book three, I mean, you can see in some ways there was an inevitability to that, perhaps.
I mean, that's the fun, that's one of the fun things is once one has read the end of book three and completed the Autumn Rain trilogy, it's sort of clear. It makes you very much want to reread the entire, and actually that's the next thing I'm going to do, is I'm going to give it some time, then I'm going to read it as a trilogy. Because I read each book as it came out, and as you came on the show, I'm so pleased for each book. But what, but now, yeah, there's a different, coherence.
Well, there's also, there's almost a lot of, you know, I don't know, Easter egg might be the wrong word, but like there's things buried in books one and two that
you had said that you had told us that.
As you start to read through it, become evident. Oh, okay, well that's what they must have been referring to.
Yeah, but I mean, I've mentioned Clark, but there's also, in a way, talking about the seminal history of science fiction, it's also like, in the very end, perhaps a smidgen of Olaf Stapledon? Is that possible?
Yeah, I think that sort of Stapledon, you know, star maker kind of thing is in the sense that I didn't just want to have it be, as I said, you know, a geopolitical thriller or even a tale of total war or even a, you know, hunt for the this is about where our humanity is going. It's about perhaps post-humanity. It's about the fact that the implications of modern science are already starting to undermine the very foundations on which our society is based.
And what
our humanity is based on. And yet, you know, so much of the human race is still ensnared and hypnotized by what I can only characterize as Bronze Age texts. You know, that this is a fascinating dilemma and a fascinating paradox. And certainly I would never, you know, compare my work to Stapledon's, but he had a huge, huge impact on me in terms of, you know, talk about science fiction taking
and
the
here's
long
a person
view.
Who's not discussed commonly.
And it's a tragedy that he isn't, because, you know, that you know, he's one of the great two or three.
Yeah,
know.
For those listening who don't know about Olaf Stapledon, let me just recommend Last and First Men as a personal favorite.
Yeah, and Star Maker.
This is turn of the century writing, last century, that is. And not quite turn, but, you know, it was early stuff. And it was seminal.
It was seminal, and I still remember Arthur C. Clarke's blurb for it, where he said it is. I think he said about Star Maker, it is majestic. It is almost unbearable in terms of its intensity.
I don't recall that.
In terms of its intensity, and in terms of its, and to me, that's what science fiction should be. That it's not just about, you know, and that's again why I was writing about the near future, is that the book ends in a way that I think signposts the way towards a broader future, towards a broader possibility, I should say.
Yeah. And ironically, that's something that a lot of fantasy fails to do. It fails to look beyond even its own place. I mean, Tolkien at least gave, you know, the Third Age? Now I'm blanking, but he refers, you know, the Age of Men are beginning. He's looking beyond. He writes about a previous age, and he hints at the fact that there are these epics beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that there will be epics to continue. But he's really one of the few, I think, that don't look at a static world in fantasy writing. It's very ironic that fantasy can be, for all of its freedom, can be very static.
Yeah, I mean, it's the double meaning, I think, in the word fantasy, right? That done correctly, it can be one fragment of a larger world and a larger time period, mm-hmm. but so much fantasy just ends up being almost like this little island, you know, where, you know, it becomes escapism. It becomes a way to just sort of, it becomes almost like a nostalgic kind of, well, if we could just keep the world as it is, mm-hmm. you know, stop the world, I want to get off. A product of future shock.
Yes, very much so.
In that sense.
And I think that's probably one of the reasons why it is so commercially viable now and makes big movies, although the movies have gone from fantasy to comic books, but,
right.
You know, that's just a graphic version of what you're describing. So it's interesting that when you say, okay, let's deal with the science fiction part of this larger realm called fantasy, the plausible part, that's when you start taking the past, present, and future. And by future, we mean the far-flung.
Right.
Here's a word that is so badly used, but in this case, we mean it literally, awesomeness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That the future can hold. And the end of the Autumn Rain trilogy is, God help me for using this word, but look it up, folks. I'm using the word as it is intended to be used. Awesome. You are left with a sense of awe, a sense of wonder is the classic science fiction phrase, but I like awe. Because wonder is one thing, saying, ooh, where are we going to go? But the awe is also a question of, oh my goodness, oh my God, how revealing.
Yeah, and you see it, like I said, I mean, there's the threads of it are there in books one and two. The questions have been set up, but I think there's a point in book three where you really start to see it coming, and you suddenly start to feel the rug. I like to think you start to feel the rug as a reader being pulled out from under you.
Yeah, yeah.
But not
Which is my favorite kind of fiction, is rug pulling.
Yeah, but ideally not in a way where it's like, oh, that wasn't a payoff or a setup that wasn't earned, that was something that... It's something that gives a retrospective order to the entire trilogy.
Yes, it wasn't a J.J. Abrams trick, as it were, where they come up with a question and then later on write an answer.
Yeah, exactly. And that was something that I was very committed to, was finishing the trilogy on a real arc, no fake setup for a fourth book, but also not asking questions that I'm not going to then answer. I mean, all the questions get answered. You know, one may not like the way the questions get answered. One may, but they get answered.
But they get answered, and the story is the story, and there is no question at the end of the third book that this was intended from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, there's the one of the best pieces of advice I ever received as a writer was never run from the implications of your own ideas. Follow those implications and follow them ruthlessly. And yeah. That's what Machinery of Light does, and now you know what the Machinery of Light as a title really means.
Yes, yeah. indeed. Yeah, it's a very literal title, actually.
Yeah,
it's poetic and literal at the same time.
It's not just a reference to the directed energy weaponry. It's a reference to something more.
Exactly. Let's go. Time is running away on the show as it is, so we're going to take a musical break, one that's musically perhaps a little thematically closer to what we're discussing than the lovely Welsh music we began with. I'm not going to apologize for that music, but it was a different tone than the one the books evoke. And we will be back in a couple of minutes. This is Straub's. Brave New World, the title song from that album. An amazing band out of, you know, with a lot of people in it, but we'll discuss that some other time. But you'd know all the names, you know, the people in Moody Blues and people in Genesis and all that. And for a while, they were Straubs. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor, as I'm wont to say. The program this morning, our guest is David J. Williams. It is his third time on the program, and each appearance has tied into the appearance of yet another volume in his Autumn Rain trilogy. And what we did not mention is, with me, you don't have to tiptoe around the room, by the way. That dancing is great. That's cool. Yeah, I like that.
Not me you're referring to there.
No. It was the little gremlins. Have you ever seen a dream walking? But now, I had a salient point and or something that I thought was clever. And
well, you were talking about each volume of the trilogy there.
Yes, I was leading somewhere. But at any rate, I was going to say we have not yet mentioned, by the way, the portal to all things Autumn Rain related, which is autumnrain2110.com.
Exactly. And lest that seem like an arbitrary number, it's a date, 2110, 100 years from now. So actually, we are now in the reverse centennial
That's
of
right.
the Autumn Rain trilogy. AutumnRain2110.com is the website where, I now have material relating to all three books.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of geopolitical data, maps, the broader world, a lot of paratextual material, as it were, a lot of hardware specs for spaceships, a lot of interesting memos, documents, that sort of thing.
I did a panel at ReaderCon. I was moderator of a panel, and Eric Van, I presume, dreamed up the idea of what are the DVD extras for a book.
What I was trying to go for there.
Exactly. And there's a lot of, and that's what a good website for work like yours should be, all the extras. And it's both a pull in to introduce people to it and at the same time a greater in-depth, a wonderful thing after you've read the book to go and say, ooh, look at that. Yes, I know that. I'm familiar with this.
Yeah, there's and a lot of it was material I'd put together even before writing the books. You know, before I learned how to write narrative, I was writing world-building material,
mm-hmm.
and then gradually inching into the narrative and the full enormity of what I was taking on was becoming clear. But also it was an opportunity to make it visual. I mean, I have some roots, as you know, in the video game industry.
That's right.
So artist friends who were putting together stuff for me and putting it on the website because I wanted people to be able to see what this is.
A very
like.
Ambitious website, by the way. If people want to see how to design nicely for the web, the website is a beautiful example of that, including some novel navigation, which I really like the way it's handled.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's autumnrain2110.com.
Okay, so you're going to read for us from the book.
Yes, indeed. So this is the first two, The Mirrored Heavens and The Burning Skies, and this is the conclusion of the trilogy, The Machinery of Light. I'll just sort of dive in. We talked a little bit earlier about spoiler material at this point with book three. There's little way to avoid it. I will just simply note that, there's nothing essential that's really being given away here, that the heart of the Autumn Rain trilogy, the surprises, as it were, that we were alluding to earlier, is something that remains very much.
Yeah, the big
intact.
Denouement is
the big
not
denouement
there, but,
is
you know,
not there.
But suffice it to say, not everybody lives through the first two volumes.
Right, exactly. And suffice it to say that you don't put two global superpowers into a book, into a trilogy, without having the sparks fly at some point.
Yeah.
So I'll read first a prologue
which means a lot to me because there is material in this prologue that was actually the first stuff I ever wrote. It's been edited since, but called Sketches of the After, and then I'll dive in to the book itself. How then to do justice to such sketches? I'll start by saying that they were imperfect representations of imperfect things. They were flesh that wants to live, reduced to ink or keystrokes, or just to memory, ground beneath the mill of time. Yet those images might survive that flesh, that memory, may yet evade the oblivion of eons, become instead the foundation for the tales that flow from old to young to ancient in endless migration across the chains of generation, all the way to when the arcs of the third planet scatter before the ravaging sun, when the descendants of apes watch the very concept of the years melt in flame behind them. Phrase the words just so, write them just right, and maybe they'll make it that far. Maybe they'll do justice to what really went down. The two 22nd century superpowers that watched each other across endless steppes and ocean, that feared and hated each other, that built arsenals that span the globe and more, looking down upon our planet from on high in space. Space. For even as the radio signals from the first Cold War echoed on the fringes of the Milky Way and sped toward the galaxy's heart, even as the transmissions from Sputnik and Soyuz raced out into the endless parsecs to join forever with those of Gemini and Apollo, the spark of conflict that set those vessels in motion flared anew in an hour when our race's promise and our race's tragedy surged together in a collision that shattered across the shards of time, leaving in its wake only this poor substitute for the real thing, babbled by a madman long gone on the sheerest midnight, riding astride that which might comprise the story of autumn rain, tales of pandemonium and glory, sketches of the after to end all others, liquid words flung down from the sky, absorbing all tears, frozen in the ground for all of winter, yet pregnant with the possibility of coming forth one day, someday, into eternal spring. So that is the prologue to The Machinery of Light, the third book of the Autumn Rain trilogy. Therein follows a detailed memo, more paratextual material to get one up to speed, which I will skip.
Although I would like to just interrupt for a moment and say how novel, no pun intended, your recap. It's not really so much a recap, it's simply a way for what you need to know to get back into the series.
Yeah, told by someone who needs to tell someone else.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not an Asimov, which has
been done before in, you know, memo, but it was just really nicely done. I said earlier about the novel method of writing the book and the present tense of it. It's just, again, it's accented very well in that introduction.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I will just, though, leap to the first page here and then, read for a little bit more, and then we'll dive back into the rest of the show. So from The Machinery of Light. A woman listens to the world burn. It's hard to miss. It's on every channel. Reports rendered in toneless staccato. Attack sequences confirmed by unseen machines, horrified civilian newscasts that suddenly go silent. The woman's jaw hangs loose while her mind surfs the signals reaching the room in which she's riding out the storm as far away from this craft's hull as possible. Vibrations pound through the walls as energy smashes into the ship from the vacuum beyond. The woman hears shouts as the soldiers in the corridors around her react to the blast barriers starting to slide shut. She hears the muffled boom of each one closing, growing ever closer, the succession of walls parading past her and echoing in the distance. She's locked into one of the modular sections now, along with 10 other guards, and the prisoner, in the high-security cell they're guarding. She looks just like the rest of those sentinels, though really she's nothing of the kind. She's not sealed in either. She may be confined behind these doors, but she's still in touch on zone, her razor awareness reaching out on the net to the rest of the ship. Nearly half a kilometer long, the Lincoln sits at the heart of the L5 fleet's defenses, on the libration point itself. The whole fleet turns around it. Beyond that is a sight like nothing ever seen. World War III began 10 seconds ago with a sudden U.S. attack on the Eurasian Coalition's forces across the Earth-Moon system. A cacophony of light hit the east, and within a second the east hit back with everything it had left. A myriad guns keep on flaring like there's no tomorrow. For many millions, there won't be. The war to end all wars is underway in style. Way behind the speed of light weapons come the kinetics. Hundreds of thousands of hypersonic missiles, projectiles, railgun-flung rocks, all of it swimming through space and streaking through atmosphere, and right now most of it's way too slow in the face of massed particle beams and lasers, directed energy batteries that flail against incoming targets, even as they triangulate on one another. On the screens, the woman can see the Earth glowing as portions of the outer atmosphere reach temperatures they really shouldn't. Chunks are coming off the moon's surface. The room in which she's sitting starts to shake even harder. She hears one of the guards praying, his words audible only inside his helmet. But she's hacked into that helmet, getting off on every word. And every word is just one among so many, because now she's honing in on Earth, sifting through the traffic that's getting through the swath of energy that's bathing the planet. It's so bad, she has to take one of the mainline routes in, riding on the command frequencies. She plunges through air that's shimmering with heat, drops deep beneath the Rocky Mountains and into the command bunker within which America's planet-side generals are monitoring events. Those generals are exclusively Infocom and Spacecom. All the other ranking officers have been purged or have sworn to obey the new order. The death of the president has been announced to the armed forces, along with the order to take revenge upon the Eurasian foe, whose assassin struck him down in his hour of triumph. There's a new president now, and everyone's getting in line fast. They're too busy dealing with the blizzard of death blazing through the sky to do anything else. But so far, the cities in both east and west are being left untargeted. Neither side can afford to bother with them. Both sides are bringing every resource they can to bear upon the challenge of breaking down the defensive grids of the other, grids largely consisting of directed energy cannon arrayed in strategic perimeters, shooting at the waves of projectiles heading in towards them. It looks to be the mother of all free-for-alls. It's anything but. The woman can detect an initial pattern already. The American preemptive strike has drawn blood. The Eurasians are reeling. She's studying the planet-side portion of the Eurasian zone now, watching the webwork of nodes that stretch from Romania to Vladivostok, from the wastes of Siberia to the Indian Ocean. She takes in the eastern grids as they struggle to adjust to the onslaught. She's looking for an opening, following the routes she's been instructed to take, moving beneath the American firewall and through a back door, into the neutral territories, into a data warehouse in London, from there to Finland, and across the Arctic Circle, and through long-lost phone lines beneath the tundra, straight into the eastern zone, straight into Russia. She's never worked the zone like this before. She's running codes that make her virtually unstoppable, swooping in across the steps, closing upon a target. The target's a man. He's sitting in the sixth car of a Russian train, several hundred clicks east of the Caspian Sea, going at several thousand clicks an hour, full-out supersonic maglev heading southeast. The train just went below the surface, and there's a palpable relief aboard at getting underground before the rail got pulverized. Looks to be a normal transit train. There's nothing aboard that's even remotely atypical, except for the man the woman's tracking. He's one of the staff officers, sitting in a compartment all his own, staring at the wall that's rushing past the window. She can see him quite clearly on the train's vid, but somehow she can't seem to get near him on zone. His codes are too good. She can trace the route they've taken, though. Doesn't surprise her in the slightest that he's come from the very center of Moscow, from cellars deep beneath the Kremlin itself. And yet he's undercover. No one else aboard this train has the slightest clue he's anything but what his ID says he is, a medium-range gunnery officer attached to somebody's staff in Burma. But the woman has been told this man is key, has been told she has to watch him closely. She expects she'll find out what that's all about soon enough. In the meantime, she's tracing some signals he's sending, riding alongside them as they flick out ahead of the train, along the rails and through a maze of tunnels, heading beneath the Himalayas, diving down toward the root of the mountains. And now we cut to a different point of view, and these cuts occur obviously throughout the books. Down here, there's nothing to see, nothing to hear, nothing going on at all. It's just the two of them now, waiting in this room. The lights of Zone went off 15 minutes ago. Too long, says Sarmax. As he speaks, the mech triggers a light in his helmet. His face is 2 days stubble and half a century's worth of lines. The only warmth his gray eyes hold is some kind of distant amusement. I don't think so, says Spencer. Who cares what you think? It's already begun. Probably. Definitely. So why haven't they switched this thing on? I presume, says Sarmax, they're waiting for their moment. Spencer nods. He figures that moment will come soon enough. The two men are deep inside something that was separated from the exterior zone to begin with. A machine that's situated in a mammoth cave beneath several cliffs of rock, cut off from the rest of this black base, with all systems shut off as an additional precaution, because you can never be too careful. Failsafe after failsafe, mutters Spencer. Hostile razors could be inside already, says Sarmax. Imagine that. We'll need to keep a close read on the politics when it all lights up. That's putting it mildly. The Eurasian Coalition is like two bodies sewn together. There's a reason its zone felt so jury-rigged, why it was so difficult to line up all the operational hierarchies. Spencer's wishing he had paid more attention to them on the way in, before they left the zone behind and reached this compartmentalized microzone deeper in the earth than he's ever been before. Parts of it were opaque to him even then, the inner enclaves, presumably, but now the entire thing's been turned off, and he's blind. He doesn't like it. Apparently Sarmax likes it even less. The mech's blind by definition. And it wasn't hard for Spencer to get him to agree to stay here until things clarify. So they remained in this chamber for the last quarter hour, just them and the unholy amount of nuclear warheads that line the walls around them. What do you think the total count is? Says Sarmax. About 50,000. Gotta be more than that. I'm talking about the ones we've seen, says Spencer. I'm asking you to guess about the ones we haven't. We're more than a click deep into this bitch, says Spencer. How the hell am I supposed to guess? But that's when he feels something clutch at his mind. Cutting. And retract. Now, sitting back here at L5, she can't reach that deep. She knows someone's down there, though. Right now, that's all she needs to know. She hauls her mind back to the borders of the zone, lets herself slot through that zone, out of the Himalayas, out beneath China, back into the U.S. zone, back out into space. Earth is getting closed off to her now anyway. The carpet of directed energy has become too thick. It's all interference now, all satellites spitting light and plasma at one another in a web that's starting to look almost solid. Earth's upper atmosphere blooms incandescent. The lower orbits are a chaos of wreckage. It's only slightly cleaner higher up. There's more space, though. And so far, both sides are maintaining the integrity of their positions. The woman routes her signal through the American flagship Roosevelt in the center of the perimeters of the American geosynchronous orbits from their ramparts. She looks back upon the Earth. And either the air down near the surface is shimmering too, or else the oceans are starting to boil. Maybe both.
But the overall picture in the Roosevelt's battle management computers is clear. The terrestrial Eurasian grids can't withstand much more the battering they're taking. The woman sets various codes to work aboard the Roosevelt. She shrinks the earth in her purview and collapses back upon the Lincoln in her own body in the room somewhere near its center, her mind taking in the duel that's raging between the American fleet at L5 and the larger Eurasian one at L4. They're going at each other, hammer and tongs, feeding in all reserve power, generators cranking and solar panels sucking in every drop of the sun that washes across them so they can surge that much more energy into their guns. The shaking in the room the woman's in has gotten so bad, it's like she's in the throes of an earthquake. Her visor's vibrating right in front of her, but she's not worried. She won't die. That's what the prisoner told her. He explained to her the reasons why, and they were utterly persuasive. She's staring at him now on a screen that looks in on her room, scarcely 10 meters away, separated from her by still more locks. She's the nearest human being to that room, or she would be, were she human. She certainly looks it. Same way she looks, like a guard. She's more of a guardian, though. And she worships the man who's not really a man and certainly not a prisoner, worships him with all her heart. Nor is her worship based on something so narrow as faith. It's based on what he's told her, on what he's shown her. Before he was arrested as a traitor and taken to this place he's in now, before she even knew the full extent of where all this was all going, back when he told her that she'd come to her room someday and sit there and watch him take in the universe, both of them hiding in plain sight at the heart of all networks, observing everything unfold. The war is almost a minute old, and it's looking better by the second for the Americans, and almost perfect for their positions arrayed around the moon. So now she focuses in on that moon, her vantage point at L5, giving her a partial look at the far side, but she needs more than that. She routes herself through to the far side center, Congreve, the main American base there, whips past its dome, drops through the city and into its basements and on into the sub-basements. The traffic is thinning out along with the wires, but she keeps on threading deeper all the same, honing in on the activity that she's detecting. Some kind of chase is in progress. She's almost at the limits of the sub-basements now, at the edge of the natural tunnels that honeycomb so much of the moon. Lava tubes bubbled through ancient magma, some of them rigged with zone and used for mining, so many left unexplored even to this day. The woman drops in around the pursuers, an elite infocom squad, and she can't see what it's pursuing. She doesn't need to. All she needs to do is hack in and do what she does best. Listen. From The Machinery of Light.
Read for you by the author David J. Williams, here over WBAI in New York. I love the impact of that. And by the way, your reading is wonderful.
Thank you.
It really gets the immediacy of that through there. So that was all basically 1 minute of World War III.
That's 1 minute of World War III. There are more.
Yeah, many more.
There are many more.
Yeah, but I think that's a very good example of what I was talking about, that amazing use of the present tense, which is so hard to pull off. And especially in that segment, it works so well. It brings the immediacy of the situation, and given all the cyber place in which it occurs is so appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting with the present tense in that I you know, had scarcely sold the trilogy than I heard a very famous science fiction author, one I have tremendous respect for, declare that the present tense was dead, and I was hoping that wasn't the case. What I like about the present tense is that if done correctly, you can accomplish at once both a sense of immediacy, but also you can sort of segue it into almost like a dreamlike
kind of intensity.
Yeah.
You know, and it can kind of straddle both.
It's the intensity that I love about it.
Positions, in a sense.
I don't know why anybody would say the present tense is dead, because in a way it was never really alive. Nobody actually does it. And so I certainly can't think of anything that is the length of the Autumn Rain trilogy. In the genres of science fiction and fantasy that uses present tense that long.
I'll tell you who does it quite well is in Walter John Williams' Hardwired.
Oh, that's right. He does a nice job there.
It's present tense.
Yeah, it is. But that's a mere novel. Well, a good one. I'm so pleased you mentioned his name, because clearly somebody who likes David J. Williams would enjoy Walter John. No relation.
No relation. Although that's the reason I don't use my middle name. Is it John? My middle name is John.
Oh my God!
Bantam said maybe
separated at birth.
Maybe I should just keep to my initial with that and let the J stand for what it might as a variable.
You know, that never even occurred to me, and really should have. Yeah, should have.
Yeah, it's one of those things though, where with the present tense, I mean, obviously, there's the intensity, there's the bit we were talking about earlier about, you know, history and how what we're trying to do is sort of give back to the present its own immediacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you now know the deeper reason why this is all present tense, and no, it's not just because it's all a dream or anything like that,
right.
but there is a sort of deeper philosophical reason why this is all present tense,
yeah.
which the ending reveals. I found it a demanding style to write in, and
I would think
perhaps all the more so, and it was stranger, is that, you know, this was how I learned, you know, to write, in a sense. I mean, these were the first novels I wrote, and, you know, spent many years on them, obviously learning to write. So it was tricky to do, and in some ways I'm glad I didn't go to a critique group for the first few years, because I think they
would
have beaten it out of me. You know, I would be writing past tense.
Maybe. I mean, it depends on the group.
Depends on the group, true.
It depends on the group. I actually sort of make a study of writers' groups.
Yeah, that's true.
Knowing people on the inside of several, and having featuring one on this program fairly regularly.
There we go.
So the right group may foster the right thinking about something like that. And when you're dealing with the genre, you really can't. You can't argue too much about form. You can't beat somebody down about it, or you're going to be suppressing
something
important.
Yeah.
For fear of suppressing. I mean, sometimes maybe it should be suppressed. But
no, exactly. And I was fortunate in terms of the critical influences I, you know, received on this, in terms of, you know, showing it to folks. And, you know, I think the key moment was when I had the chance to get it in front of Peter Watts, who's a good friend of mine, and, you know, obviously a brilliant, brilliant writer.
Yeah.
May he win the Hugo in a month for the Island. But he,
I think he's a good bet to win it only because of the border guard.
But oh my God, the whole border guard situation. The Island is just a genius story in its own right. But mm-hmm. he read the first draft of Mirrored Heavens, or, you know, the 20th draft of Mirrored Heavens, something like that, and he said, you know, I love it, but it needs an ending. And I thought, well, I thought it was supposed to end on a cliffhanger, and that was when I had a 5-book series planned, and I sort of collapsed them around and changed stuff, and that's ultimately what became the Mirrored Heavens.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was very encouraging in that regard, but that was fairly late in the process,
right.
You know, as I was putting it together.
Let me mention to people, by the way, that if you would like to call up and speak with David J. Williams about his work, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. And, you'll need headphones
for this
segment. So what about the Autumn Rain experience and other media?
Well, that remains an open question, particularly now that the trilogy is completed, that the trilogy is done.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, I know I asked you this actually the first time you were on the program, but it has a different resonance now that it's all complete.
Yeah, and it would be, you know, it would be tough to do in some other media in the sense that, you know, if I think about, like, you know, a screenplay or something like that, you know, you couldn't tell this story in 2 hours. You could tell it perhaps as a mini series or something like that.
Well, what about, you know, talking about DVD extras, what about an immersive game?
Yeah, a game would be great because you could envision it being done either as a real-time strategy.
And whatever became of Homeworld 3, by the way?
Oh my goodness! It's Homeworld 3. You know, remains, I think,
an open
question. It's I mean, it's one of those things, right? Where Homeworld itself, the first game, was a special confluence of, you know, personalities and ideas, and where
it's a wonderful game.
Where Vancouver was at that point, where the game industry was, is, you know, just taking off.
Yeah.
In Vancouver.
I mean, I could go back and play it today. I don't care. You know, my video. You don't need a new video card for it either.
I mean, again, the original Homeworld got back to that point you made earlier about, you know, the word awesome. You feel the grandeur of space, you know. I mean,
yeah.
and you know, Homeworld 2, a little bit more mixed success, and in some ways that was a product of the success of the first game. Was mm-hmm. that, you know, I mean, the first one was basically just done out of a warehouse, and, you know, it was just ideas being pitched, and there was a lot more sort of bureaucracy by the time of the second game, and the third one, I think, you know, that's more of a rights battle at this point. I
know nothing about it. Obvious that there would be a place for it.
I no longer keep up with it, and everyone I know at Relic Entertainment has subsequently left. But to your point about, you know, you could envision this, the Autumn Rain trilogy, either being, you know, real time strategy a la Homeworld, you know, a la what you just heard.
Yeah.
Or, you know, much more of a sort of intrigue, agent by agent, mission by mission kind of thing.
Well, there's a name that actually appears throughout the Autumn Rain trilogy that is still my favorite name in video games, and that is, of course, Infocom.
Mm-hmm.
The text adventure is not dead.
Mm-hmm.
And you could imagine being a character, yes, a graphic immersive thing, but can you imagine little side trips one could take just in text within the Autumn Rain worlds?
Yep. Yep.
The things you could control, the things you could do through text only.
This is true.
It would be a wonderful retro-futuristic.
I originally actually was intending to try and do some of that on the website, you know,
yeah.
Just to literally and just eventually, you know, kind of realized that I needed to sort of get on and actually finish the book. But, you know, that you're It is a story, you know, of documents, of you know, Le Carré does this so well,
mm-hmm.
right, where, you know, you're talking about who knows what, and, you know, you're talking about intelligence agencies that may have been penetrated by rival intelligence agencies, so there's a question of reliability of data, and there's a greater uncertainty of the narrative that goes on
and
there.
This is the kind of thing that you can pull off so well with text. Based adventure. I won't say text adventures, but text-based adventures.
Right.
I bet that something amazing
mm-hmm.
could be done with that if people were brave enough to think the best graphics in the world are done with text adventures.
Yep. Yep.
You know, and that's the second best. The best are done on radio. The best graphics.
There is that.
Second best in text adventures. Let's take some calls. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Oh.
Hello.
Well, let me run away from my radio.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay. All right. Now, first, to the author, of course, I've forgotten the name.
David Williams. David J. Williams.
David J. Williams, who have actually was surprised how... I'm glad this book was well accepted and now going into its second run printing, the first book.
The third book going into the second printing, correct? Yes.
Oh, great!
Yeah, I mean that's runaway success. When 2 months after the book has been released, it's into its second printing. Yeah.
Yeah, because I wasn't sure what was going on because I was asking around about it and I was kind of getting fuzzy answers from the Barnes & Noble people or whatever. And, of course, I'm going to actually have to pick up all the other books because there was a misplacement. There was like an accident in my house. So, but that's okay. If I find the old books, then they'll become presents to someone, you know.
Right.
But now what I wanted to ask is, where are you from, first off?
I'm from the UK originally. I mean, I'm sort of, you know, Anglo-American is probably the best way to describe it, but my...
But the accent is Aussie.
Yeah, my dad's Australian, so, you know, there's a bit of that sort of British imperial heritage going on there.
Okay. Well, I'm actually Australian, too, but I've been in the States for a long time, as you can tell from my accent.
But David is, by the way, for the most part, from Washington, D.C.
There is that. I've spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., the hub of it all.
Were you folks in the diplomatic world?
No, my father used to work for Comsat Labs, Communication Satellite Corporation. So, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, if you had expertise in satellites, you either defected to Russia or you went to the United States to work, and I'm glad to not be in Moscow. So, you know, and in some ways that actually was a little bit of, I think, an influence on the Autumn Rain trilogy. I mean, the Mirrored Heavens refers directly to the satellites overhead. And in trying to sort of tell that story of, you know, a reignition of the second space age, which is really what occurs across the 21st century. That's one of the things I was focusing on.
Well, now if you had been Russia now, you may have been part of that new generation of, especially Moscow, a new generation of billionaires. They have the largest per capita billionaires in the world.
Yeah, it's Tycoon is a great movie, by the way, if anyone's seen the Russian... billionaires, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, because, you know, part of the question there is that of, you know, geopolitics, right? I'm postulating that, and a lot of people are writing Russia off. I'm not inclined to. The events of the last few years, I think, you know, established that, you know, Russia is on a resurgence.
Yeah.
They certainly face grave demographic challenges, but they are a dangerous people to write off, and they are a great people, and I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, I wanted to make them part of that future superpower in the Autumn Rain trilogy.
Yeah, political theory might change, but the desires of a nation doesn't necessarily change.
Well,
you
put.
Know?
Well put.
Actually, that's not my line, though. I can't take credit for that one.
Well, you said it.
So are you, like Jim, also involved in the tech world?
You know, actually not especially. Jim has far, far more knowledge about tech and hardware than I do. I come at it more from a historical point of view. I mean, my degree is in history. I spent several years in the management consultant world, you know, corporate strategy, that kind of thing. And my involvement in video games was not from a programming perspective, was from a storytelling perspective. So, you know, for me, you know, the technology is very much a means to an end. You know, I mean, I mentioned earlier the LEO elevator, the low orbit space elevator. You know, like most of the technology in the books, that was not something I invented. That was something that I, you know, researched and thought, that's something that would be a likely development or a possible development by that point. So trying to sort of calibrate it against that larger timeline.
Well, I mean, you're creating largely a hard science fiction piece, so most of your stuff would be already out there. I mean, that's a credit, not any kind of denigration.
Right.
No one should think that way because that's silly thinking.
I agree.
Yeah, you're trying to sort of extrapolate, you know, where is all this going, you know, and at the same time trying not to bury the reader in technical detail, right? I mean, that's the other challenge, I think, with hard science fiction, you know, writing is that, you know,
to walk that line of technical detail and story at the same time, it's the thing that Clancy pulls off that makes him so readable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. I don't want to occupy the phone anymore, so I just want to ask one more question. Now, you do this, because I lost the books. You do this present tense, and then you'll jump to another point of view. How is it you seem to do that without losing the writer of who's talking about who? Is this
there are section breaks. There are very clear breaks in the book.
When he was reading, he said cuts.
Yeah, I did catch that.
I probably should have mentioned something as I started to read.
No, it worked. You didn't have to. It worked.
But there are no. It's a good point. There are no chapters strictly defined, or rather, you can think of the book as being a series of very small chapters.
I would use the term cutscenes. It's a perfectly good phrase, and it's what they are.
My original editor, Juliet Allman, had the brilliant idea of putting symbols standing for each character point of view.
Especially in the final phases of the book, as we're cutting, it works so well.
Exactly. So you do have these symbols which help you sort of path your way through the narrative.
But I mean, by strict definition, wouldn't they, from a literary point of view, be then defined actually? I mean, you can call them whatever you like to call them, but aren't they by definition actual chapters? Just even if they're small.
Yeah, you can call them that. They just aren't numbered as such. Oh, you know, it's not like 42, 43, 44. It's just simply break.
Interesting. Okay. Well, anyway, let me jump again. Great. Are you going to be reading in town at all?
This is pretty much the final event of the
Of this particular book.
Of this particular book, yeah. So you might see me back at some other point. This is the finale of the Autumn Rain World Tour.
Right. Yeah. Well, I hope you have something on the table, or revisit this world, perhaps.
That would be cool. Like, I could definitely envision some prequels.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. We really have like 2 minutes left.
Yikes.
It's amazing. But so I'd love to get to more calls. But the problem is that there are more questions. Like, and here's one in two words. What's next?
What's next? That's the inevitable question.
It really is.
It is indeed. And part of it has been just simply saying goodbye to this trilogy, right? I mean, you know, saying goodbye to these characters and being at that crossroads. I'm working on a couple of screenplays, unrelated. One science fiction, one not. Novel-wise, though, I'm actually looking at, believe it or not, ironically, fantasy. I have a specific...
Nothing ironic about it, Justin.
Ironic given our discussion earlier. I have a specific alternative history, fantasy, steampunk, clockpunk mashup that I'm considering that could be gloriously entertaining if I can pull it off right. And I've been doing some research, I've been doing some notes, and actually I intend to lay pen to paper this coming Monday. So it's very much real time. I'm hoping to get it into the market and pitch it across the fall. And I'm pretty excited about it.
We've got Whale Punk coming up on the air, by the way.
Set in the ancient world, and that's all I'm going to say about it on air right now.
Ooh, okay. So a lot to look forward to. And hopefully, because it's going to be a while before that sees print, hopefully you'll be here on Hour of the Wolf before that. You don't have to have a new book to come on the show.
I would look forward to that.
Good. Very good. So let's see. Oh, my God. Well, we're there, aren't we?
Indeed.
1 minute of World War III and 2 hours of The Wolf.
Indeed.
Later. They grow up so quickly.
Indeed.
So, first of all, everybody listening, autumnrain2110.com is the portal to all things Autumn Rain related. I won't say all things David J. Williams, but it's a good entry point. And you'll get the names of all the books in the trilogy. Although I'm hoping at one point you can just go into a bookstore, say Autumn Rain, and you'll get.
I would look forward to that.
The whole thing on your device or your iDevice.
But start with the Mirrored Heavens. That is the first book in the trilogy, and then the Burning Skies and the Machinery of Light.
Yeah. So again, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for your flexibility in having mashed around with the dates.
No, not at all, Jim. I really, really appreciate you having me on here 3 years in a row. This has been great.
And we'll go for 4 years.
And it's a fitting way to wrap up the trilogy.
Great. So thank you so much. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next week with a different agenda. Stay tuned for As I Please with, Simon Locally and, a bit of Melville. Stay tuned. Out on the
You are tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. And good morning, and hello, and welcome to As I Please for this, the 31st day of July in the year 10. And I, for one, am so happy to see July go. It has achieved the dubious distinction of personal worst for me. It has been a long, grueling, miserable month, but it is almost over, and I would like to express my appreciation for notes of concern. I was laid low last week with brain fever. And a lot of people ask me about brain fever, and they say, well, what are the symptoms of brain fever? And it's not so difficult. It is essentially what it is, a fever in the brain, and not contagious as far as I could tell, although I suppose one has to have a brain to determine that, which means safe here at any rate. Just kidding, you know I loves you. But the primary symptom was indeed a fevered brain, and, you know, who knows, but perhaps my switching between King Lear and William Butler Yeats was a cause of this feverish state. But I actually wound up using an ice pack. Now, in those wonderful screwball comedies of the 30s, you would often see people getting up in the morning and having an ice pack on their head, and this was all because of a supposed hangover. Now, I'll tell you something. In my time, I have had a hangover, but I've never before actually used an ice pack. It always seemed a bit silly to me. But last Saturday, as I was just, you know, just absolutely miserable, I said, the head is so hot, it's just burning. So I dug out an ice pack and found a measure of relief. Sometimes on the back of my neck, sometimes on the top of my head, sometimes resting on my forehead. So the ice pack proved useful, that and ineluctable bed rest. There was no choice for it. You know, sometimes when people are sick, you know, when people have a claimed absence due to one ailment or another, they seize this time to go about and accomplish a lot of those little chores that they just don't otherwise have time to do. Going out and getting vacuum cleaner bags or things like, you know, all those little things. You're not really 100%, but you're not so ill that you can't get something done. Well, this is not the case with brain fever, let me tell you. I had no choice. I really had no choice. And all I really wanted was to have enough strength to make it to Stand Up Academy, which I did, and which seemed to be the right thing to do. Now, I have noticed among my comrades in the tour business, we have a shared difficulty in recuperation. You know, people come down with one thing or another because we are constantly exposed to the merciless elements. And you might be down for a couple of days with perhaps a fever or a runny nose, and then you feel strong enough to go back, and yet you never really get back to being 100%. Now, I've noticed this among my friends in the tour business. And this suggests to me that there is something fundamentally sickening about the job, which has its ups and its downs, quite literally. But when I think about this, and the last couple of weeks, you know, I have crawled into work and just not been able to do it. I'm just so wasted, man, just so wasted, and not in a good way, I can assure you, not in a good way. And so what is the cause of this failure to recuperate? And I blame asbestos. I've decided that asbestos is the source of all ills in the world because there's a lot of it still. You know, every time I go by a construction site, and I go by a lot of construction sites in a day or two, I notice signs about hazardous material, and 9 times out of 7 that hazardous material is asbestos, because almost any building built 30 years ago or more probably was just lined and coated with asbestos. And couple of weeks ago, I was in a subway station. They were taking out one of the token booths. Remember when they used to call them token booths? Because they're laying off people left and right. So they're taking this out, and there was a sign saying, a warning, asbestos removal. And you say, you know, everywhere. So I blame asbestos, and I think there's a lot of asbestos just in the air, not to mention in this room, because, as is well known, asbestos is also a wonderful soundproofing quality, and it's fireproof. Soundproof and fireproof. Perfect for a place like WBAI. So I do regret the loss of one episode of King Lear. Last week's program, which, you know, I had worked on, I had prepared, was entitled Mean to Me. And little did I realize how prophetic that title would prove. But illness was mean to me anyway. But it was essentially going to be a talk on how King Lear means, or how or why and what it might mean. But because I have only a limited amount of time, and Lord knows they're not going to give me extra time, and all of these episodes of the summer series were sort of laid out way back in March or April, according to, shall we say, the hidden architecture of an ongoing series. Now we're just scrambling to catch up, aren't we? So I have decided that the episode Mean to Me of the summer series will be presented live and more or less all together at the September Stand-Up Academy. As I said, I worked on this program, and I think it has some points of merit. So for those of you who are just so ticked off that, you line up, you go out, you buy the play, you get up early in the morning to listen to the radio, and this guy gets sick, he's useless, and then there is no, not even an effort to make some sort of substitution for an episode of King Lear. Well, stay tuned. The September Stand-Up Academy will be Mean to Me, Ways and Hows of Meaning in Shakespeare's King Lear. That is the plan. That is more than a plan. It is my solemn vow to you, dear listener. And speaking of dear listeners, we return to fundraising mode sometime next week. And although they are still vague about how long it will be, it is nonetheless our annual summer emergency drive. Now, you would think, after all these years, some fevered brain might consider, are there alternatives to on-air fundraising? And, of course, my fevered brain's working on this, and I was tossing and turning, sweating, I know what we could do. We could set up an apiary on the roof of 120 Wall Street and produce delicious New York City Pacifica honey. Until I discovered that it is against the law in New York City to keep honeybees. Apparently, Bloomberg has as much distaste for honeybees as he has for cigarette smokers. So, okay, we'll scratch that. After you get stung, I guess you will scratch that. But then another one that I was talking about just a couple of weeks ago. Why not doesn't WBAI buy a couple of buses and we could give WBAI tours? You only need two or three buses, and I know at least one legal tour guide who is associated with this station who would be happy to provide this unique radio service, where you hear us talk about the city all the time, now you get to see it from the top of a double-decker bus. However, that, of course, would require not only getting some people here who could drive and drive at the proper pace for a tour bus, but it would also get us all involved with insurance and the legal paraphernalia of having properly licensed drivers and guides. It's a notion at any rate. And then there is downstairs here at 120 Wall Street, an empty restaurant. Well, there's potential there too, don't you think? Because if there's one thing that we lack here is a proper performance space. And so the idea of moving into the restaurant downstairs and offering lunch and light fare with the certain roadhouse quality at night, music and entertainment. And this would sort of divert our attention from the relentless nagging on the air for money to actually doing something that people would be willing to pay for. At a lovely, large restaurant that seats maybe 500, it really is big down there. However, all of these things require management skills not readily found in the Pacifica Foundation. And, I'm being honest. Running a radio station is one thing, but running a business is another. Hey, am I right or what? I'll say he's what. So then I'm thinking about this, and I say, why not an auction? You see, a lot of people, when they come in here in management positions, they have ideas for fundraising, but it never really gets far beyond the idea of a cake sale or taking all the free books that come into the radio station and then having a book sale. Well, this might raise $10 or $15, but it's not going to answer the problems of our constant black hole of financial our financial incompetence or our financial suffering. But an auction. Now, I'm not sure how it would work, but I know that we have a couple of tape recorders around here that aren't regularly used. We could auction. And these are industrial strength tape recorders. These aren't those little things that Mr. Phelps would listen to at the beginning of Mission Impossible. No, these are big. So we get some people here to cannibalize and clean up and make sure that they're working. And then we would auction off these tape recorders, of course. We run the risk of auctioning off them all, meaning that those of us who actually still use tape, the medium of tape, would then be bereft. So we'll have to take that into account. Certainly chairs. We've got plenty of chairs. A couple of years ago, somebody brought in something like 150, 200 wooden chairs, which are all around the station, because it was really a testament to BAI's stunning ability to fanny about. You know, we do a lot of setting about here. So we have all these chairs, far more chairs than we could ever possibly use. And they're lined up here in master control and in the hallways. And everywhere you look, there are these chairs. So you can auction off these chairs. I say auction because we're not going to have a